trust associated with all those other wise acts comes into question. In the golfing case, just because I missed, you know, getting a par three on the second hole, or I missed a putt, doesn't call into question all of my other successful putts. But if I was found to have cheated on a hole, that would bring my whole game and reputation into question, because people operate on the assumption that I follow the rules.
Okay, so in the case of a golfer, we're saying that we can assess his skill based on the acts. It doesn't matter what he does in the rest of his life. So that will have no mitigating effect what he does in his personal life, so on, as long as we can accurately measure how honest he played golf. And even if he has one bad day, but if he had a fantastic record despite that, he still retains pretty much a pristine reputation as a golfer, because it's all based on acts.
No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, Tiger Woods being the penultimate or the classic case. If you're talking strictly about his ability to play golf,
yes,
then what he does outside should have no matter, but I don't think that's practically the
way. Well, no, I don't. Yeah, I'm not taking up the my concern is not. I want to assess the just to isolate his golfing ability. So to assess somebody's, you know, level, I would only look at what he has done. And once I look at, let's say, 100 games, if that's what they call it, that he played. So if 99 games he won and he beat out everybody in the world, in one game he didn't. So that one game is not going to really have much of an effect. Right? 99 out of 100 games, he is the top golfer in the world. So that's an amazing record. And that one game is not going to have the effect. And we say, however, by a person who's a wise person, that he can be wise his whole life and have great honor, great wisdom. But if it is one act of foolishness, it could ruin it all. So why does it ruin it there, but not by golf? So you're saying that by golf, it's act, whereas by the wisdom, it's what? What would you categorize that?
Seems like it's connected somehow to the trust that people put in a person to live according to the values and the character qualities that they're espousing. We set a certain expectation for character qualities.
But let's say the guy's lived. See, let's say this guy's an 100-year-old guy, fully coherent, competent, and his entire life he lived righteously, upright, intelligent, all this. And then one day he does something very foolish. Why is that going to destroy all those previous decades? King Solomon says it does. It wouldn't do that by the golf game. It wouldn't. It wouldn't have any effect on all the perfect games that he shot up to this point. But in terms of a wise person, he's saying that a little bit of foolishness can destroy it.
I wonder if it's because it shatters the image, almost the myth, that people have of the person.
It does. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
If you go 99 years, people have an expectation in their mind that this guy is perfect. And then so he goes and does something, you know, unrighteous. The myth is shattered, and even though it's only one act compared to millions he did in his life, the cracking of the myth is much more, or the cracking of the image is much more profound.
Agreed. I would just like to understand why that is. How is it that the person will now allow that one case there to crack the image? And what we have to really get it behind that. Like, what is the reason why there is an image? But in terms of the golf, you don't have such a thing called image. As the, you know, just using your example, I think we have to go a step below that. You know, an underlying cause.
There's something about moral qualities, which is rarefied. It demands a certain standard of perfection that a craft doesn't carry.
All right, what is it? We still got to get down to it. You see, the case of the golf, what we're doing is we're assessing actions. And those are discrete, isolated cases. Did he get the ball into the hole from this distance with X number of swings or not? If those are the facts, so that's what he's done. Nothing else can change that. So nothing else has any bearing on that. Those are all the factors. It's a very small set of factors. But what we're doing is we're assessing actions. Now, by a wise person, I believe the difference is that we're not assessing actions per se. What we're doing is we're saying that the person is functioning out of a certain attitude, a certain approach to life. So it doesn't matter how many times a wise person did something completely intelligent, because if in one case the person does something completely foolish, so that shows us that he is not a person operating exclusively by intelligence. I mean, we're not assessing, it's true that it's one instance, it is one action, but we're not doing an assessment of actions. If that was the case, we couldn't penalize him for one action if a million other actions were perfect. But what we're saying is it reflects an attitude of the person that we had the wrong understanding of all this time. Because a person who is truly wise, and I'll quote a verse, Rabbi Mann had mentioned it to me years ago, but it stuck in my mind. It's a verse in Samuel 1:18-14. And the verse reads as follows. And it was that David, in all his ways, was intelligent, and God was with him. It was that David, in all of his ways, all of his actions, was intelligent, and God was with him. So there's two things there. The first thing is really what it addresses us. The fact that God was with him shows us a concept of providence. But the first thing it tells us is that David, in every single one of his actions, was intelligent. There was nothing. There was no breach. Rabbi Chait once said that the person who's living properly, there's never an area where he gets a little outlet for his emotion. A lot of people have that. Most people probably have that, where there's like Miller time type of emotion, where they feel justified to go off the path a little bit just to vent. But the person who's wise, who's righteous, he never does that. The God said to Abraham, perfect should you be with God. Perfect means that there is no deviance from the path at all. Because once there's even one minute change, that now shows us that the person is not operating exclusively on intelligence. And that's why it's comparable to the vat of perfumer's oil, something which is priceless, the top of the line, something which by its very nature is a pure metal, not an alloy, meaning like, for example, 24 karat gold has a much greater value than even something which is, minutely less. Even if we detract just a little bit, you've broken the quality of purity. That's not a quantitative issue. I mean, there's a certain quality. Once you have a person who's acting pure, or pure oil, or pure gold, that is qualitatively different than any alloy. It's not just that you have a little bit more gold. Now there's a whole new status to it, like a flawless diamond. Why does it have a reputation as flawless? Because it is rare. It is something which, by definition, has reached its maximum perfection. And that's something which is the same by a wise person. And any type of a deviance from that, even a little bit of a foolishness, that's why he says that. That's why he says that in verse 10:1, that more weighty, more significant than the person's wisdom and his honor will be a small amount of foolishness. Okay, so it's not that we're assessing actions. If we were, then we'd have to be comparable to the case of the golfer, who we assess, you know, who we assess based on the actions alone. But here it's not actions we're assessing. We are assessing the attitude of the person. And once we see in a person he could do something so foolish, he could not have been that wise person we thought of all along. It's just that he never came around to venting that part of his nature, which was he was carrying with him. But this now reflects the fact that if he could do this now, that means it's been there all along. That means that was his disposition all along, but he never vented it. He never really showed that side. It's like looking at a diamond from, you know, 25 different angles. It looks fantastic. And then you turn one side of it, and then you see this great defect. Now you don't care that you saw a perfect image on the 25 other facets. Now you know that the diamond really contains a flaw. Do you see the distinction?
Yep.
God even says this, that he holds the righteous and he judges them by a hair's breadth. I think we mentioned that last time. That the more perfected the person, the more God judges them. And I think Ibn Ezra brings that down as well. And he says, let me just find it. Yeah. So Ibn Ezra says as follows. He says, one sin to a wise person is very, very harsh. Do we not see, regarding King Solomon, that God appeared to him a number of times? And he built the temple for God's honor. And he increased and widened his wisdom from all those prior to him and even those after him. And there was not found any flaw in him. And because of one sin, they didn't search after his wives, what they were doing, that they actually made temples to their gods with his money. So that's why it's written about King Solomon and what has been written about him. I mean, it attributed to him a thing that he worshipped idols or something of that nature. Of course he didn't do it, but he didn't stop them, he didn't look after them, so it was considered very grave, even though he did really nothing. But since he was so high caliber of an individual, such a high caliber individual, and such greatness he accomplished, and such wisdom that he had, that demanded that a higher level of action. So if something very small, he just didn't search out his wives to what they were doing, see, the Torah attributed to him something negative. So he gives an example, King Solomon. There's another example, too, I believe he quotes. And he says further, and don't wonder about this. Because every single sin, small or large, it's in accordance with the greatness of the one who performs it. That's how it's measured. Inasmuch, and he says, similarly is the matter when God said, with those that are close to me, I will become holy. That's when Moses was consoling his brother Aaron, with his two sons who were killed with a offered a strange fire. So they were held to a very high level, and even though they wanted to go in and do some sort of an intent to worship God, but that deviance was not tolerable for people of that level, that high caliber, and they were killed. Okay. All right. All right. Any questions?
What's the source again for the comment that the reward of a sin depends on the greatness of the person who does it?
This is the Ibn Ezra. And it is on at the very end of 10:1.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. And again, there's another rabbi saying that God holds the righteous accountable by a hair's breadth. That's another one. That he judges them that meticulously.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Ones that were killed. So I just want to take you back a minute to the last thing before you answered.
Go ahead.
All right, were killed, right?
Yeah, what's the question?
I wanted to make sure in my mind was what he was saying. It was the sons of Aaron who were killed.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay, so you see that it's a very tenuous type of a thing. I mean, the status of a person, it's not like a person that did so much righteousness in his life and he's piled it up and he's got that in his lot. You see that he said that, you know, one sin can destroy much good. We said that earlier, right? Where is that? Right, that was 9:18. Let's see what Ibn Ezra says on that. He's saying over here, Chote Echad. He's saying, the example, here's one deviant person, one renegade. So that will, that could destroy much good. All right. Let's see if Rashi has anything on that. Here Rashi gives an example. Let's say Israel was a split. Half the people were righteous and half of them were wicked. And then one person comes and he sins. And now he tips the scales. That being most of the people are now wicked. So now he'll tip the scales that everybody's going to get punished as a whole. So he gives an additional explanation how one act of evil can have tremendous far-reaching effects. Okay. Now he goes on. And this is now second verse now. So it's 10:2. And it says, the heart of the wise is in the right, and the heart of the fool is in the left. And it just means to say, when we say right or left, that right, a person is right-handed is his majority. For some reason, that's how it is. I don't know why. Most people write with the right, or that they are righties, and they have stronger control, and the right became euphemistically used in Torah as being something which is more of a direct, powerful, and secure type of an action. When you do something, do it the right way. So that's why even English language has that term. Okay, and righteousness. So you see it all comes from there. Now, the question is, what is he saying now? And what's the connection to the previous verse? That he now says the heart of the wise is in the right. All right, so this we're going to need a little explanation. Ibn Ezra comes to the rescue. And he says as follows. The matter is as follows. He says, that this, that the intelligence of the wise person is with him, and at the time of need, he will find it readily available for all of his matters very quickly. And the opposite is also true with a fool. It's like his heart is in his left hand, because the right hand has more strength than the left, and it can do things more efficiently. Okay, so that's Ibn Ezra's statement over here. He says again that the matter is again that the intelligence of a wise person is with him, and at the time of need, he'll find it readily available to help him with all his matters very quickly. So what is this additional point of 10.2 coming to tell us? What is so significant here that King Solomon used ink and he wrote this verse? It can also be the attitude. You have to have a sense for the context. I would say here that the here means the inclination. I mean, here the leaning of the wise man is to the right. That means that it's proper. He has the right approach in life. Whereas the heart of the fool is to the left, maybe meaning instinctual.
Well, could it also mean if we're saying that, okay, the right is this, you know, the strong side, the standard side, the one you automatically turn to, that the wise person keeps his intellect in that position in his life and operates naturally from that. That's what he naturally turns to, whereas the intellectual understanding of the fool is at his left. It's sort of minor, and that his emotional life is this, the lead, the thing he automatically turns to.
Yes, you can say it that way.
And could it then be that King Solomon is not stating this? I mean, it is a fact, but he's also stating it as something over which you have control. In other words, if you observe that the wise man keeps his intellect, you know, at the ready, then that suggests that to be a wise person, that's what you need, one of the things that you need to focus on.
Yes, Sivorno says it. He says that that the wise person puts his intelligence in his right hand and his instincts in his left hand, meaning that his intelligence rules over his instincts.
Right.
And he says further, therefore, when a wise person does the opposite, and he does an act that's foolish, he'll be embarrassed by his foolishness, and it'll be a disgrace to him. But what's his message? And he says in three, it appears connected, because you see how he starts off three. He says, and also, so that has to be a continuation of the thought in number two. So in three he says, and also, on the path that the fool travels, his heart is lacking, and he says to everybody, I am a fool. And Ibn Ezra says on this, that the fool, in all of his involvements, in all of his speech, he appears that he's lacking intelligence and knowledge. Even when he walks in the way, it's as if he's calling, his soul is calling out, as if, right? And he's making known his disgrace. And he tells everybody his lackings to all people. That's what it means that, quote unquote, he tells everybody that he's a fool. Of course, he's not saying it. He's, you know, a person has a certain amount of dignity. But what he does, it's as if he's telling everybody, look at me, I'm a fool. As if with his mouth, he's telling everybody that he is a fool. All right, so that's Ibn Ezra on 3. So he's adding something more. So there's an idea in 2. And then he expounds on the fool in number 3. So we have to get to what that idea is, and then understand what the necessity is, and then also what he adds in verse 3. All right, the question's clear to everybody?
Yeah, and I'd like to augment it with another question.
Augment away.
If it's, we talked about the wise and the fool in verse 2, so why does he purposely select the fool in verse 3? Because the opposite should also be true on the road, for a righteous person or a wise person who has understanding, his acts would let people know he's an understanding person.
Okay, I hear you.
But why did King Solomon specifically zero in on the fool? And is it possible that it is actually more noticeable when a person is foolish than when they are righteous? And so when the fool walks, and he's by his actions, he says to everybody that he's a fool. If you had a comparable righteous person on the other side of the scale walking alongside him, the people will notice the foolishness of the foolish person more than they'll notice the righteousness of the righteous person.
Yeah, intuitively, that makes sense. We'll have to define why exactly, but I agree with you. I mean, it could be that when a person is living properly, so then there's no mishap. He goes to work, he comes home, all the things that there's no conflict. There's nothing that is seen in physically in his actions where there's any type of, you know, bottleneck in his life. So it doesn't catch any attention. Whereas the fool, he falls down. I'm just using, you know, metaphors over here. He'll fall down, or he eats the wrong foods, and he doesn't show up to work because he's sick, or you know, a number of different things that since he's fighting how the world operates, so you'll see him deviating, and that will catch the eye. That will catch the attention. So that's why he talks about that in 3, because that's where there's an apparent conflict in the activities that we see. There is a certain sensibility that people have to get things done. They know they have to eat, have clothing, have a home, so they understand and they see how to acquire this thing. So people in the whole will, you know, everybody, I mean, frankly, 99% of the world is interested in working and works. It's the fool that deviates from that and doesn't work, and that catches a person's attention. What's this guy doing on the street all day long? How come he's not getting on the train and working and doing what's necessary like everybody else? So that's the deviant case is what catches the eye. And then, of course, that person will tend to be more disheveled, will tend to be, you know, much more, you know, riddled with problems, will tend to be maybe with his hand out, so that catches people's attention too, whereas everybody else is going their own way and there's no conflict, there's no they're not going off course. So I agree with what you're saying. But let's go back to verse 2 now. What does it mean that the heart, what is the message over here? What is so significant? That King Solomon is saying that the heart of the wise is in the right. And again, what does Ibn Ezra say? He clues us in a bit. He says that the intelligence of a wise man is with him, and at the time of need, he'll find it readily in all matters. So I believe what he's telling us is that, he again, this is a string of verses about the greatness of wisdom. That's what we've been discussing for the past couple of weeks. So another greatness of wisdom, he's telling you, is that it is something which accompanies the person. Once a person lives an intelligent life, so that now creates in him he's predisposed that whenever something comes up that he has to address, like Ibn Ezra says, he initially approaches it from intelligence because he's conditioned. God's design of the person is that the more he's involved in wisdom, the more he's attracted to it. And that attraction, and he sees that that's really, number one, practically, that's how the world operates. But it appeals to his mind that that is something which is, that's how the world operates. The world doesn't operate by just guessing or throwing a penny into a wishing well instead of going to work. He understands after many, many hours and days and years of study that there's only one way that the world operates. There is a system. So as soon as something comes up where he has to address it, he immediately is drawn to that conviction and his trained mind. So what happens is that person's learning, he becomes very attracted to wisdom, and he's adapted his lifestyle to follow it, and it appeals to his mind. And one day, a year later, all of a sudden something comes up, and it's something he never really faced before. So he immediately has all the tools of his Talmudic study and his Torah study at his fingertips because he's been trained and he's conditioned. And you don't lose that, right? I mean, you don't lose that unless you want to. A person continually learns, it builds up more and more his analytical skills and his objectivity and his control of his emotions. All the factors that go into assessing something properly and understanding his perceptions accurately, weighing the facts, analyzing, questioning, and arriving at a solution. So all that he has with him has sharpened over the years. And now when a new scenario presents itself, he draws on all of that. But again, he has behind his skills, there is the attitude, the conviction, that he knows that this is how the world operates. It would be foolish to just say, I'll shut my eyes and I'll pick one of the choices, multiple choices, without even looking. That's a ridiculous thing. He would never do that. He understands that if he analyzes the phenomena that he has in front of him, and he analyzes it, then he can come up with the best solution. He's very secure in that. Like we said before, the King David, in all his ways, he was intelligent. But even on top of the intelligence, God was with him, because there's only so much you can do on your own, independently. So perhaps that's why the end of the verse tells us over there that God was with him, meaning to say to address those areas that are outside of man's reach, which are many. There's only a certain amount of variables that are under our control. So when King Solomon says here that the heart of the wise is in his right, that means that as the person has trained himself to live a certain way, so when, like Ibn Ezra says, the time of need, he will find it immediately. Meaning his intelligence will be right there, ready, waiting for him. Because he's trained himself, but also because, more primarily, that he has developed an attraction and an ally with his intelligence. And that's what he always calls upon when he has a need. Because this is something which he sees is true. This is how the world operates. And he's attracted to that. So it stays with him. And that's the first recourse, and the only recourse, that he takes when he has to arrive at a solution to something. So King Solomon is telling you an added benefit, that not only that when a person uses intelligence, that he sees great wisdom, and that it's something which is very pleasing internally, and it does solve problems, but not only that, there's an attending nature that it has, that it remains with him. That's what this verse is telling you, that it's readily available. That means it remains with the person because of the attraction and trust he's built with it, So that's something which is an additional benefit to the life of wisdom, that it's with you, and it's something which you can call upon instantly. That's his big point here. And of course, the opposite by the fool. He's so used to satisfying emotions, whenever a problem comes up, he just reacts emotionally. He hasn't controlled his emotions, and even the intelligent person, the wise man, that even he may have an emotional attraction to do something when a certain scenario arises where it requires his response. But since he's trained his emotions during his life, he'll have benefit from that too. He's not going to just simply give into an emotional impulse. He stops, he puts the emotions in their place, and he looks at it purely objectively and intelligently. If an emotional response is warranted based on his intelligent analysis, then he'll use it. If it's not, so then he won't. But the emotions are under the discipline. They're under the guidance of the intelligence. Whereas the fool is just the opposite. He just wants to feel good. He doesn't care what makes more sense. Even if something appears sensible to him, he's so used to doing things on a gratification type of an approach that he'll go for that first. All right, we see it.
Think so.
And you see, it's good that it follows the previous verse, because the previous verse was talking about how why it is that a little bit of foolishness can destroy wisdom and honor. Because really, wisdom and honor, we said, is something which has such a high caliber that the person should be living that way all the time. So it's that person who lives that way all the time that he'll have the benefits that King Solomon talks about in the next verse, which is the one we just read, which is verse 2. And I think this naturally answers verse 3 also, like we already said, that since a person is a fool, and he's running contrary to how the world operates, so this is something which is a deviation. And things which deviate catch the attention of people. If people are, you have 10 people that are following the norm, and they're smooth sailing, that's good. You have 10 sailboats in the ocean, they're all smooth sailing, and they're going with the wind. Then you have one guy is going the opposite direction. He's fighting the wind. His boat is going back and forth, rocking in the waves. That's going to catch your attention more, because he's deviating from the norm. He's deviating from how things operate. And he says that we're even on the path that he's going, meaning how he approaches things. It's even, prior to doing the action. And it's as if he's telling everybody. I wonder what more he's trying to tell us. Why isn't he just saying, verse 3, also on the way that the fool goes, his heart is lacking? But then he adds on, he says, and he tells everybody that he's a fool. Meaning his actions are so poor that it's as if it's so apparent. It's so distasteful. But why does he add that in at the end of the verse?
Rabbi, is it to reinforce the point that what jumps out at people is the thing that doesn't fit the pattern? If you look at a pure white tabletop and there's one blotch of red ink on it, even though it takes up just a very tiny amount of the space, that's what people's eyes will zoom in on because it's not in accordance with the pattern of what's expected.
Yes, I agree. But is there anything to the point that he's saying, because here it's like it's bringing in others. That would be fine if we just said that in the path that the fool goes, his heart is lacking, and his ways are deviant. But it doesn't say his ways are deviant. It says he tells everybody. It's like bringing in an audience. If we're just trying to address that his acts are deviant, and you wouldn't have to bring in an audience, right? You just say his acts are deviant. But to tell me that is as if he's calling out to other people and saying that he's a fool, that bothers me. There's something more there. Right? You don't have to... What do I care about other people? No, I'm not saying there's a delight. I'm questioning the need for King Solomon to add on that element, because if he's merely trying, in 10:3, he is merely trying to tell us the corrupt nature of the operation of a fool. So all you have to do is tell me, and also on the path that the fool travels, his heart is lacking, and his ways are at a loss, or his ways are deviant, or he loses out, whatever. But to say the final couple of words, and he tells everybody that he's a fool, it's bringing in an element, a social element. I mean, if I'm looking at, you know, an experiment and it goes wrong, so I look at what went wrong. I don't care how many people saw it go wrong. You see what I'm saying?
I think so, yes. Thank you.
But it would seem to imply that the social element is something which is a important factor here. So now we have to ask, what is it in the fool's lifestyle unless you want to tell me that, well, I mean, I don't think he's telling us that the person thinks he's a fool. Because even though he says, he tells everybody he's a fool, I don't think he's aware. But I think it may be saying that he's so blind to the impact of his foolishness that he has no problem telling people what he's planning to do. He's bringing the social in as a barometer to how blind the person is. A person would not do that. If a person was convinced that something was wrong, he wouldn't share it with his friends. That would make him a laughingstock. But since ego is the primary mode of operation of most people, so perhaps what King Solomon is telling you here, the person who's a fool is so far gone that he does not see any drop of negativity. To the point that he'll even tell people what he's doing. And that has to be the case because if a person's operating out of emotion, that means he's not operating out of intelligence. So there is no way to weigh the how incorrect what he's doing. It's just not registering on this individual. All he's concerned is that it feels good. It's gratifying. So it's as a barometer of how blind a person could be, King Solomon tells you that he tells people what he's doing. He tells people his foolishness. Of course, he's not aware that it's foolish. But we're talking objectively. We know it's foolish. But since he's so convinced, he sees nothing. It does not register at all because there is no faculty that he's cultivated in his life that has the ability to assess and to evaluate. He just acts very impulsively. Yeah. Okay. So any questions or comments?
We're good here.
Okay. All right, so I guess we'll wrap up here. That's what I had prepared for today. And Doug, maybe you could do me a favor, just check out on the audio page for me and tell me how the sound is on the last couple of... if you give me about 10 minutes, I'll post this one too, and I'll put the date on it, and then you can let me know. Because I don't have another PC here to test it on. If I did, I would. For some reason, I can't do it on a Mac. So if you can give me like 10 minutes and then go to the audio page on the site and let me know how it sounds.
And you need it to be done through a PC.
Unless you can hear it on a Mac. It doesn't matter. If you have the ability to hear it on a Mac, that's fine also, but I think it's only a PC file, but either way.
Okay, does it stream live or does it download the file onto the computer?
On the PC, it streams live.
Okay. I'll see what I can come up with.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. So everybody have a good week, and we'll pick up next Sunday, same time.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
I love you,
Patty.
Thanks. My pleasure.